House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. First item on the agenda is House Bill 2345. Open a public hearing. Call Senator Cruz, Justice Brewer, and Ben Swade, please.
Welcome, Senator Cruz. I mean, formally.
And Senator, when you're done, please feel free to leave. I know you have other meetings to be to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, a member of the task force that was chaired by this great gentleman sitting next to me. And when you have him in charge of something, the product usually turns out to be pretty good. In this case, it was a really good product, but not quite exactly how we wanted it. So I do want to commend the work of the work group and the product we have and the importance of us being able to do this work this session. But I part of the reason I'm here is we have a similar bill on the Senate side, but with some slight alterations. One of the things that I was concerned about after we saw the work product was that I did not want to get in the way of those counties where they had a good system. Multnomah is a prime example where the low end issues were being dealt with by the district attorney's office, and then there was a handoff to DOJ at a certain point in the process. And we wanted to make sure, and I think that the same thing is happening in Marion County, and I believe Coos County as well. So we wanted to make sure that we did not prevent that sort of collaborative work from happening. And so we did an amendment to the bill, and we thought we had it right. And it turns out it wasn't quite right. And so I've had meetings with DOJ and with the governor's office as well. And we are in the process at this point in time of redrafting the amendment. Kind of one of the major points in that redraft is to make sure there's a hard handoff at point of termination. So that goes to DOJ, which is totally appropriate. So the chain of tells me that we're still waiting. So, Mr. Chair, I know that that Senator Olson and Senator Barker are both co-sponsors of the bill that's in the Senate at this point in time. And I'm glad that you're hearing this bill so that you know full well what the issues we're dealing with are, because once our bill is right and we move it, it goes to Ways and Means, so you won't have a chance to review the issues. So it's important that you're doing that here. And I just wanted to commend Judge Brewer and the members of the task force for the great work that we have done to get to this point.
Hey, thank you very much, Senator.
So, and with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to go to my committee.
Okay. Thank you for coming over.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, members of the committee. My name is Ben Swade. I am the general counsel in the governor's office, and I appreciate, on behalf of the governor, the opportunity to testify about House Bill 2345. My general view, and I expect it's yours as well, is that the governor's lawyer is best served to remain seen and unseen and heard, or seen and unheard, or not here. But I'm breaking with that tradition to underscore how very important this bill is. It's important to the governor, certainly, and much more crucially, it's important to Oregon's children and to Oregon's families. I also want to briefly acknowledge, as did the senator, the immense amount of work that went into the Senate Bill 222 task force, chaired, of course, by Justice Brewer, and the work that went into the final report, which forms the basis of the bill that you're considering today. On behalf of the governor, I particularly want to thank the task force's legislative members, which include, of course, Representative Stark, as well as Senator Cruz. And all of the members of the task force and the countless stakeholders and very passionate advocates from across the state who helped to work to guide the work of the task force, I know are closely watching the progress of this bill. They deserve our thanks and they deserve our support. As many of you already know, the issue of dependency is one of particular importance to Governor Brown, who has fought for children and families here when she was in the legislature, certainly as part of her service as governor and as Secretary of State, but also in the courtroom, where she served on the front lines in representing numerous children in the dependency system. The issue of representation in dependency proceedings is not a new one to this state, as you all well know. For over a decade, various work groups, task forces, and advisory committees have sought solutions to the serious challenges that are plaguing the system. We know that outcomes need improvement. We know that children and families are not being as well served as they should be by this system. We know that a big step in the right direction is to provide better representation for everyone who is caught up in these processes. We know that our caseworkers are spread too thin and don't like to go to court because they could be doing other work on behalf of children. And we know that cost is an issue. It's going to be hard to fix this without investment. But I'm pleased to say that after thoroughly researching best practices here in Oregon and across the country, the 222 report and this resulting bill propose major reforms for all of the systems that provide parties with representation in Oregon's dependency proceedings. It affects the state agency, DHS. It affects the state's law firm, the Department of Justice. It affects the way children and parents and CASA engage with this system in productive, positive ways. In addition, the report in this bill proposed to put in place a quality assurance process to ensure that these changes and the legislature's investment in these changes actually improve the outcomes for Oregon's children and families. And it provides a mechanism for a direct feedback loop, both to providers and to the legislature, so that you may continue to propose, debate, and enact important systemic improvements as we go forward. The governor appreciates the hard work and compromise that was required of all participants to get to today. She stands behind the recommendations of the task force, and she stands behind this bill. After more than 10 years of work, we have a real opportunity to solve this very real problem for Oregon's families and children. On behalf of the governor, thank you for listening, and thank you for the considerable work this committee does to improve the lives of our families and our children.
Thank you.
Chair Barker and Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm a judge on the Oregon Supreme Court and had the privilege of chairing the task force on legal representation in childhood dependency, and we appreciate the time you've given us today to present a brief summary of the findings and recommendations of the task force. And I want to echo Ben's note of appreciation for the support we received from this body, the space, the staffing. Shannon Newell was a fantastic help to us as staff, and for the encouragement you gave us to take the time to do this as best we possibly could, given the opportunity that really is critical at this time. You know, and I don't need to remind you, that the court dependency system supports and oversees the larger child welfare system in Oregon. And in that role, the dependency system protects the legal rights of parents, and it promotes sound decisions, good outcomes for children, and it ensures that the Child Welfare Agency, the Department of Human Services, is accountable to the laws and policies that govern its work. A strong dependency system is critical to a well-functioning child welfare system, and that's why the work of this task force couldn't have been more timely, and why our findings, frankly, I think are very important and shouldn't be surprising to anybody. For about 15 months in 2015 and 16, the task force, which consisted of 18 members from all three branches of government, and I really want to put in a pitch for three-branch work. It's amazing how much we can get done together in understanding our respective roles. And we also involve many stakeholders in the process, local and national experts, and we gathered information on Oregon's child welfare outcomes, our current model of dependency representation, local promising practices, and national best practices. We held 10 meetings statewide that included opportunities for observing court proceedings. We met with practitioners. We supported five subcommittee processes, or I should say Chana did, and we engaged in many informal stakeholder outreach meetings. The task force held meetings in Multnomah, Lynn, Jackson, and Marion counties, and we offered opportunities for public comment at each of those meetings. We all did our best to ensure a robust and fair process govern our work. Sometimes the conversations weren't that easy, but everybody was respectful and honored our essential goal of protecting children and families' rights. The strength of this report depends on and has depended on the efforts of child welfare leaders from all three branches. And the objectives of protecting families and children spurred us to take a fresh, hard look at the efficacy of our current representation models, think beyond the status quo, and always put children and families first ahead of any of our personal interests. So after that process, we made a number of findings, and I want to only highlight three of those for you. You've all had access to our broader report. If you're like me, you like executive summaries. There's a five-page executive summary up front. If you have a chance to read that, even if you don't have time to think a lot about the rest of it, I really strongly encourage you to do that. But I want to highlight, please, three of the findings. First, that our current system for government representation in dependency cases, in which DHS caseworkers regularly appear at hearings without their own legal counsel, is a national outlier. That practice leaves the agency and the state of Oregon open to potential legal liability for uncounseled decisions and at risk of the unlawful practice of law. It's inefficient, it's costly, and it results in inconsistent practice across the state. And although lawyers who represent parents and children have performance standards that have been developed in consultation with the Oregon State Bar, government attorneys in Oregon, at least currently, do not have corresponding statewide standards to guide their practices. Second, our current system for parent and child representation in dependency cases is not meeting the needs of Oregon families. With the exception of three counties, an antiquated payment system and a history of underfunding have forced parents and children's attorneys to take on high caseloads where they're constantly triaging case emergencies and court appearances, which leaves very little time for effective case management, client counseling, and planning. That isn't the case in three counties, where the Parent and Child Representation Program, a national best practice approach, has been introduced. In those counties, which are Lynn, Yamhill, and Columbia, attorneys are paid based on a workload model that includes caseload caps. Under that model, the attorneys are able to spend the time necessary to prepare for court, work with their clients, and avoid unnecessary case emergencies. And then the third finding is that, and also an important one, we believe strongly in a systems approach and that Oregon needs a coordinated quality assurance process to track dependency data. We need hard data on outcomes for children and families so we can provide a feedback loop to practitioners who can then identify problems before they become disasters and develop solutions that will improve their practice. So in light of these findings, and after evaluating a number of different alternative models of representation, including models that are in use around the country and have been proposed in other states, we've made several recommendations that we believe will produce better outcomes for children and families. I want to highlight several of those. First, we believe strongly that DHS should have full representation from petition to permanency in child welfare cases. In the current system, DHS is the only party that is not consistently represented by counsel. The agency charged with making critical placement, removal, and welfare decisions that can change the lives of children and families, sometimes forever, needs consistent advice and legal counsel at every hearing, like all other parties to these cases. And we believe that representation should include both attorney presence in the courtroom as well as access to legal advice and oversight throughout the life of a case. We believe that this will promote case practice that conforms to the law and that it will better support caseworkers who are overburdened and in some instances burning out because of the extra volume of legal type work that they currently have to perform. Second, to ensure full representation, we urge that the Department of Justice, which is the entity that represents DHS by statute, negotiate a flat fee billing model and staff cases according to a workload model with case caps. Dependency cases are like no other cases handled by DOJ. They bring its lawyers into court on a daily basis. They require regular and consistent contact with and oversight of the agency. And the client consists of literally hundreds of individual employees who need direct access to legal advice on a regular basis. Because of the unique nature of this work, we believe that a different billing model is required and that to fulfill its statutory role, DOJ should work with the Oregon State Bar to implement lawyer performance standards that will ensure a high standard of practice throughout the state in these cases. Third, district attorneys are authorized by statute to represent an entity that is distinct from DHS. They represent the state, or the people. This is a unique role in Oregon dependency practice, and nothing in our report is meant to prevent district attorneys from continuing in that role. That being said, the task force has overwhelmingly recommended that legal service funds allocated to DHS be used to ensure full representation for DHS, the agency whose decisions have to be right on the facts and right on the law. Fourth, the task force recommends that funding be provided to roll out the parent and child representation program, the contracting model that includes case caps, to the rest of the counties in the state. This program, which is modeled on some very innovative work that was done in the state of Washington, where it's in place, has provided attorneys with the time they need to better engage clients and to proactively manage their cases, and it's also begun to improve outcomes for parents and children in the counties where it's being tried. Finally, among other recommendations, I want to highlight just two. First, a continuous quality improvement team, we believe, should be formed that is led by the Judicial Department's Juvenile Court Improvement Program. We've got one in place that's very active and led by my colleague Leola McKenzie here in the room today. We believe that this team should monitor the effectiveness of the dependency system and provide continuous feedback to practitioners to promote a culture of constant system improvement in this critical area. We've also asked, subject to your approval, that a voluntary group of individuals, most of whom participated in the task force, continue to meet from time to time to monitor the implementation of the task force recommendations and whatever bill you enact, and to promote system efficiencies, that three-branch work that we think is so important. I want to conclude with just a couple of observations. Everyone here in this room is realistic. We know that you face significant budget challenges this session. And we also understand that you may hear suggestions that legal representation for all parties in dependency cases is either unnecessary or that other priorities should be put ahead of it. Needless to say, we disagree with those arguments. Adequate legal representation is an investment in child safety, and it's a backstop against costly mistakes that have threatened public trust in our child welfare system. To protect their rights, parents and children need attorneys at every hearing, and to protect children within the court's jurisdiction at all times through sound legal advice, four core principles from our report should never be lost. And they are, first, that the attorneys representing the interests of DHS must, at a minimum, have an attorney-client relationship with DHS. Second, those attorneys must provide consistent, competent legal counsel and representation that reflect a unified legal policy statewide. We shouldn't get different justice in Malheur County, in other words, than we get in Multnomah or Marion. Third, those lawyers need to work within a system that provides meaningful lawyer supervision and oversight and monitors the lawyer's performance and adherence to the highest standards. And fourth, the lawyers need to know, with all respect, and understand the deficiencies in DHS programs and practices that were identified in the public knowledge report that's been presented to this body. And through the legal services they provide on behalf of DHS, those lawyers need to support reform efforts to correct those deficiencies and prevent their recurrence. So you know this isn't the first time that Oregon has examined its dependency representation system, but it is the first time, I believe, that cost-effective system-wide recommendations for reform have been proposed in a public process. Driven by a three-branch core, this bill has done everything we can to take an objective view beyond the status quo to promote comprehensive system improvement in this area. And we believe that the findings and recommendations behind it embody principles that will best protect the rights of our families and improve the outcome for our most vulnerable children. So we thank you for your time, and if you have questions, I'm glad to answer those, and my colleagues are. I know you're on a tight schedule, so unless there are questions now, we can wait and go back later.
Representative Vile.
Chair Barker, Judge Brewer, you mentioned that we're a national outlier. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Yeah, it is extremely rare if not non-existent, Representative Vile, for there to be a dependency system anywhere in this country where the Child Welfare Agency doesn't have a lawyer at every hearing. That's what I mean by an outlier. That's the part that really is a fundamental key core principle, and that's why I highlight it.
And are we the only state left?
As far as I know, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Justice Brewer, honestly, for all of you that worked on this, good job, and thanks for doing that. I do have a question regarding Section 2, since it identifies somewhat of a, almost kind of like a finding, a description. And I'm wondering, generally I don't ever see anything like that in a bill, and I'm just curious your thoughts on why that was placed into the bill.
And are you on the finding section, Representative Olson?
Yes, Section 2.
Section 2, page.
So it'd be first page.
Page 32 is the second recommendation. Is that the one you're talking about? I apologize.
He's looking at the bill. He's looking at the report in the
bill. Oh, in the bill itself.
Yeah, in the bill itself. I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. I think, Representative Olson and Chair Barker, members of the committee, I think that the best way to describe that, and others may have a slightly different take on it, is that that is as much of a table-setting explanation of how we got here and why the bill is important as it is anything else. We see, as you know, from time to time, bills where legislative policy is expressed in an opening section of a chapter. And this, I think, and others may have a better way of explaining it, this isn't the guts of the bill so much from a policy standpoint, in my view, as it is an explanation of why it's urgent and what brings us to this point.
Okay,
so
thank you.
If that's not the answer that you need, others will be glad to pitch in.
No, you did well.
Thanks.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we'll call Brandon Murphy, Allison Kelly, and Walt Beglau. Please.
Good afternoon. Senator Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brendan Murphy. I am a Marion County Deputy District Attorney. I am co-chair of Marion County's Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Team, MDT, and I was honored to be a member of this task force's subcommittee for crossover youth. I want to start by acknowledging the leadership of Justice Brewer throughout the many meetings of the task force, as well as take a moment to publicly acknowledge the hard work of Addie Smith as well, who helped coordinate this monumental effort. Without their leadership and professionalism, in my opinion, this would have been far, far more difficult conversation. Members of the committee, what it means to be a great prosecutor, it's evolving. There will always be the tough on crime definition, but increasingly great prosecutors understand local families and they take a holistic approach to family safety. House Bill 2345 doesn't explicitly prohibit DAs from being involved in dependency work, but it does affect budgets, which make a practical barrier for us continuing this work moving forward. And I'm here today to hopefully communicate to this committee just how absolutely critical local district attorney's offices being involved in dependency work really is. Let me give you some examples as to why your local prosecutors need to be involved in dependency systems. So a prosecutor's decision, for example, on whether a father should become a felon, it probably should include consideration about whether or not that father is cooperating with an open, active DHS case. Because when we make people felons, we change the trajectory of families. It is a fact that youth in foster care are far more likely to have increased contacts with juvenile justice systems. And it is a fact that child welfare systems disproportionately contact children of color. So DAs lose an opportunity for diverting crossover youth, those youth who are both in foster care and involved in juvenile justice, when they're not connected to what services can be provided to youth in a dependency context. And local DAs must understand how dependency systems can fuel disproportionate minority contacts into criminal justice, and so that we can make appropriate policy decisions. For example, it doesn't make sense to file allegations on a youth merely because investigators, whether DHS or law enforcement, weren't able to generate a safety plan with a family that speaks a different language. That's not an appropriate solution. Oregon's entire child abuse multidisciplinary approach to preventing child abuse relies on cooperation and coordination. A deputy district attorney that understands both the criminal ramifications as well as dependency law is best suited for leveraging current resources into child safety. Respectfully, in my opinion, the conversations in this task force did not spend enough time discussing how representation models can impact local child abuse MDTs. The less cross-system understanding that attorneys involved in child lives have, the less effective MDTs become, which places children at risk. And an example of that would be if DHS is going to remove a family from a violent father, remove the children, that attorney better understand what's required to support a dependency petition and better have the ability to coordinate with local law enforcement to make sure that that removal occurs safely. And those things are exactly what the MDT is obligated to do. So there are just a few of the reasons why DA's involvement is critical. I would look forward to any questions or ongoing conversation. But moving forward, the task force did find, and we look forward to working with DHS on ways that we can bring more value, standardization, and improved performance in these very, very critical cases. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please. Good afternoon. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Allison Kelly, and I serve as the CEO of Liberty House, a child abuse assessment center serving Marion and Polk counties. I'm also the chair of the statewide Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. There are 21 of those centers serving 36 counties. In many of our counties and in Marion County, we serve, and I serve as the co-chair of that local multidisciplinary team. I did submit written testimony, and I would refer you to that letter. I just have a couple of points to make. In your consideration of this bill, to also keep in mind those provisions of ORS 418-747, which is the statute that embraces that multidisciplinary team concept. And I hope that the provisions of this bill won't undermine any part of that. It's really necessary in three major phases of a child abuse investigation: that early intervention phase, the middle where there's the investigation going, and then the outcome, the sentencing. And in my letter, what I wrote was the reason for this multidisciplinary approach, and our policy in the state of Oregon is really good, and I say that as a public policy geek who's facilitated a lot of complex public policy issues in Oregon for nearly 20 years. But the reason is that child abuse and neglect investigations are really challenging. They require professionals, including our DHS partners, to derive meaning or to understand what's really happening with a child's situation from very nuanced indicators. It's never only about the injury. It's always about the entire context surrounding a child. And as in many complicated areas of law or public policy, not all the partners have all the information at all the right times. So when you bring together a CPS worker who has one piece of the information and a detective or a responding officer who has another piece of the information, and that district attorney and your child abuse assessment center, which is a key part of that multidisciplinary team, you're going to have a higher likelihood of all the right pieces of the information coming together when they need to come together and the better decisions being made for the case and for the case outcome. So with that, we hope that however this bill moves forward, you do preserve that ability in some counties of being able to have your local DAs serve with that role of the dependency representation. And this is where the mediator in me comes out. We're in the realm of and what is also true. All the things that are in Section 2 of the bill, I've talked with Director Sakey about, all of those things are true. And what is also true are these other components, that in particular counties where you have high volume and it's working well, let's not undermine that. If we don't have the right pieces of information at the right time in the right way, It will increase the likelihood that you will have children who are subjected to severe injury and or death because we weren't able to put all the pieces together. All of us are concerned about that. All of us are concerned about that. So that's really my point. Thank you for allowing us to be here today.
Thank you.
Yeah, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, and Vice Chair Olson, good afternoon. My name is Walt Beglaw. I serve as the District Attorney of Marion County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I spent the lion's share of my real career doing child abuse prosecutions. I just want to thank the task force. I had an opportunity to actually attend one of the meetings and give some testimony, and in particular the leadership of Justice Brewer through this process. It looked like everyone on the committee had a vast knowledge, long-term understanding, a commitment to child safety. So that's a wonderful flag for Oregon. And it looked like every committee exposed areas where we can leverage current resources and just make better decisions for kids earlier and more effective in a collaborative way. And that is all good stuff. We do have some areas of improvement to make. We always will, and we're always going to be right at it. This bill has some very strong elements and features. Today, as this conversation continues, what I'd like to share is we would ask that there's careful consideration around the following. The task force was charged with finding best representation model for dependency proceedings, an essential question, and I'm very respectful of that. That question is not necessary. The same question is what's best for kids and families. For example, I understand that this bill does not require a dual mandate. That is, it doesn't require the agency representation must both act in the best interests of DHS and to the children themselves. And that's a very important question to till the ground around. ODAA, the district attorneys, believe that at least one attorney in the proceeding should be advocating for best outcome of the child rather than their client's direction. Creates that playing field that's very important in making decisions around family. We agree that access for high quality representation for parents and children is critical. We also agree that decreasing caseworker legal responsibilities, freeing up their time, taking that stress and mandate, that so much work for those folks to do on an hourly basis in our caseworkers. We agree with that, but there's an opportunity to do that in other ways. So we're committed as district attorneys to continue to work with DHS to make the systems of representation more uniform, standardized, and efficient, training aspects. We're doing that now, and we have a ways to go. We're also committed to leveraging our current resources and existing relationships in a way that helps them focus on what is important, and that is families. So I'm here today on behalf of the DAs to say we're well positioned, I might say organically, if you will, to achieve those objectives for Oregon's families. So thank you. We're all rowing in the same direction here, and we want to be committed to this this dialogue around dependency. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions to this panel? Thank you, panel. The next call, Nancy Cosine, Clyde Sackey, Sakai, Fred Voss, and Stacy Cowan.
So whoever wants to start first, if you'd identify yourself, and Mr. Sykes, Director Sykes, you look like you'd be a great one to start.
Be happy to. Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Sykes, Department of Human Services. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2345. So this is an issue that has kind of been longstanding. I had a conversation with Representative Krieger before he left office, and he so kindly reminded me that we've been working on this issue for 12 years, and he was very hopeful that we would come to some kind of a conclusion one way or the other. You know, I've worked in the department for 23 years, took a vacation and left, and then came back again a couple of years ago. And really, in being part of the task force, I think that from my experience, this has been the most comprehensive and in-depth look at that, at this issue. And the work and leadership by Justice Brewer and Addie Smith led us to a place where I think gets us really what we need to be able to do our job. And so we wholeheartedly endorse the recommendations of the task force. So Justice Brewer mentioned a couple of points that I don't want to repeat, so I'll move through them very quickly, because one of my principles is when you want to kind of know what the issues are, you go to the people who are actually doing the work. You don't sit in your office and say, well, I think they think this or I think they think this. So we actually put together a group of district managers, program managers, and child welfare supervisors and caseworkers, and really set. So when you're talking about legal representation, what are the key points for you? And Justice Brewer actually had some of them come in to talk to the to speak with the task force itself, which I thought was a great move. So just to kind of reiterate what Justice Brewer said, and to really kind of convey to you what we heard from our staff is, we really need the attorneys who are with us to be representing DHS or the agency and not just the state. And it may sound like, well, DHS is part of the state, but there is a subtle difference there. And sometimes, because of liability or other issues, what may be a course you would take, which would be in the best interest of the state, may not be in the best interest of the child or the family. We also need representation from the very beginning of the case to the end of the case. And right now, with the handoffs, it makes it a little bit awkward, and at times things are lost in the transition. And so having a consistent person represent us through the life of the case is very important. And also consistency of representation throughout the state. I think Justice Brewer said it, and I wholeheartedly agree. The representation you get should not be an issue of geography. You shouldn't be get a different level of representation just because you reside in Portland as opposed to Ontario, as opposed to Baker City. And then finally, huge piece for our caseworkers, training and consultation in between cases in preparation for court. None of our caseworkers go to school and come out and they don't want to be attorneys. That's not a role that they're trained for, not a role that they really want to assume. And so it really, that preparation for court really is critical to them. And just a couple of other points, and then I'll stop and turn it over to Stacy. We do know through exit interviews that this lack of representation is a factor in a turnover rate for our caseworkers. It's not the only factor, don't get me wrong. There are a number of reasons people leave the agency, but it definitely is a factor from people who really don't, again, want to practice law and who have had bad experiences in court. And typically when we go to a hearing, and when I decided I was going to be part of this task force, I actually went to court in a couple of different counties just to have that firsthand experience. You're at a real disadvantage when the child has an attorney, the parents have an attorney, and the only person up there by themselves is our caseworker. And then finally, I just wanted to put on the record that we value our relationship with the district attorneys. The multidisciplinary team approach is a solid approach, gets good results, and really, no matter what the outcome is, you know, we're committed to continue to reach out, to collaborate, and to work with the district attorneys, because we feel that relationship and working together is in the best interest of children and families in the state of Oregon. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you.
So, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee, Stacey Cowan with SEIU Local 503. SEIU represents thousands of workers statewide, including the frontline workers at DHS, and I don't want to repeat anything that Clyde said. We appreciate the comments very much. We just wanted our opportunity to put on record our voice of support of the work from the task force, as well as the recommendations that came forward and ultimately House Bill 2345. Our folks feel it's absolutely essential that we decrease caseworkers' legal responsibilities and ensure that caseworkers and child welfare staff have access to legal representation in court proceedings, most importantly, to protect children and improve outcomes for families. But also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that it's important at a time when we have case loads that are so high that folks are stretched already to the point of not being able to do their work effectively and really feel ownership over that work. So we really feel that this is an important piece of the puzzle when looking at and evaluating how caseworkers are spending their time and making sure that we have a system that's moving child welfare forward. So with that, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson. My name is Fred Boss. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2345. Representation in juvenile dependency is extremely important to the Attorney General. She directed me to participate in the task force, and I did. And I'd like to thank all the members of the task force, in particular Justice Brewer and Addie Smith, who provided us a lot of direction and actual organization. DOJ has a child advocacy section that represents the child welfare division of the department. The section's attorneys are in court for hundreds of cases or hundreds of hearings each month. The work of the child welfare requires regular and consistent client contact on critically important decisions related to child safety and families. It has become clear to us that the DHS caseworkers need regular consultation and representation from DOJ attorneys throughout the life of a case. DHS caseworkers need their own attorney representing them in courtroom at all hearings so that judges can make decisions based on all of the relevant facts and the applicable laws. When this does not occur, unnecessary mistakes can be made at a great cost and strain on the system, not to mention Oregon's children and family. We accept the mandate of Section 4 of this bill to work with DHS to ensure that all caseworkers have legal representation based on a workload model with case limits and a flat fee billing model. We will report back to the legislature in September on our model, and that will be fully implemented by January of 2019. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Nancy.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, Nancy Cozine, Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services. Thank you for having us here today to discuss this very important bill. The Public Defense Services Commission sincerely appreciates the leadership demonstrated by the Governor's Office, by Justice Brewer, by our legislative members of the task force, and all the other stakeholders. This was indeed a very thorough process. And as you've heard, it was an in-depth examination of our dependency system all across the state. We heard from both national and Oregon experts in dependency casework. And each of the recommendations that are being brought forth to you were the result of well-researched, thoroughly vetted proposals, and they're really keenly focused on improving outcomes for Oregon's children and their families. I was part of the Alternative Models Subcommittee, and that subcommittee was charged with identifying different models used across the country. We actually examined six different models of representation for parents and children. We looked at each one, and when we were evaluating them, we were looking at specific attributes of high-quality programs. So consistency, continuity, availability, local community connection, manageable caseloads, outcome-oriented practices, cost-effectiveness, multidisciplinary approach, as well as duration and scope of representation. When looking at different models through this lens, the parent and child representation program mentioned by Justice Brewer was the clear outstanding choice. The only other model that had similar outcomes was a full-time FTE model, and that model was much more expensive than our parent-child representation program. So for that reason, the PCRP really stood out as the leading program. This program has three independent and critical components. We have a client-centered, sustainable legal representation structure. We have case managers who are available to help in about 10% of the cases. And then we have quality assurance and oversight. I have written testimony that gives you more information about the details of the program, and we've also testified to you about this program before. So I don't want to take up too much of your time. I think the key things to take away are that this program ranked well because it's cost-effective, it addresses long-standing challenges in our dependency system, it's evidence-based, and it's easily replicable. So in Oregon's PCRP counties, which is modeled after the Washington State program, we have seen that we are those counties are experiencing reduced use of foster care beds, reduced time to permanency, preservation of families, and we are also seeing improved quality of representation. So the task force endorsed the PCRP because it is an effective model, and it does improve outcomes for Oregon's families that struggle to navigate what is an increasingly complex dependency system. The task force endorsed House Bill 2345, or at least its legislative concept, because it ensures appropriate representation for all parties in the system. The Public Defense Services Commission encourages you to pass House Bill 2345, and they sincerely appreciate your time and attention to this matter. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel.
Are we in a work session?
Close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2345.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 10th, 2017.
Okay, Councilor, you want to give a brief?
Certainly, Chair Barker and members of the committee. The Dash 1 amendments limit the Department of Justice representation to dependency proceedings only. Prior to that, the underlying bill allowed for representation on things like certification of foster homes and licensure. It also clarifies the flat fee charged by the Department of Justice must be a flat fee. It's not discretionary. It makes additional findings and then several technical and clarifying changes.
Okay. Are there any questions? We have a motion to introduce the Dash 1 amendments. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2345 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. With a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2345 with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with the due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Are there any questions? Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Burke. I just want to again say thank you. I had an opportunity to participate in this. Mm-hmm. A lot of people put in a lot of hard work and over a long period of time to get it to this point. So I'm impressed with you guys. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you. Are there any objections to the? So moved. And we'll have Representative Stark and Representative Olson co-carriers on the bill. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2776.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2776 is Chair Barker's bill. It deals with guardianship of a person with a disability who is in need of a guardian. A person with a disability in this measure and elsewhere in statute is defined as any person with a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more major life activities, has a record of such an impairment, or is regarded to have such an impairment. The measure specifies that the guardian will enforce the rights of the protected person to receive communications and will provide notice to the appropriate persons and entities upon death or hospitalization of the protected person who is a person with a disability.
Hey, thank you. I call Carrie Kaysen, Kathleen Brown, and Ione Daniels, please. We can have a fourth with Kelly. Could come up also.
The what?
Okay. You can go ahead and testify in any order, but be sure you state your name for the record when you start testifying.
I'll start. Hi, my name is Carrie Kasem. I'm president of the Kasem Cares Foundation. Thank you so much, Representative Barker, for carrying this bill. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, and committee members. My story was very public. My father being Casey Kasem, when I was blocked from seeing him, it wasn't just me. It was my brother, my sister, his aunts, his uncles, his own brother, and all of his friends and family. We were told we were never going to see my dad again. And this is a man we saw every week, talked to every single day on the phone. When he was diagnosed with Parkinson's Lewy body dementia, we knew that his wife would do everything in her power to keep us away from him when the time came. So a year before he died, we were literally told, you got to get used to never seeing your dad again. And we thought, well, that can't happen. We'll just call the police. We're his kids. And we called the police, and they couldn't do anything. They did a welfare check and said he's fine. That was it. We called Adult Protective Services, and they went out there, didn't even go in the house. They just listened to my stepmother say he's fine. These kids are awful. They're estranged. They're coming back for money. All these lies, lie after lie after lie. Then we went to court. And we had to prove that we were good children. We had to show pictures. We had to show that we were involved in our father's lives. I offered to show my bank account. All of us kids work. We all are self-sufficient because of my father. He never gave us money. This was not a man who just gave us cards and money. He said, if you want to respect yourself and have self-respect and work ethic, you buy the things that you want, because if I give them to you, you will never respect them, and you will never take pride in ownership. That was who my father was, and that's who I am today. So we decided to fight. And when we realized that there was no law allowing adult children to ask for visitation to their own parents, you had to go through an entire guardianship fight or fight over power of attorney. Most people don't have the means to even get a lawyer to represent them. A retainer fee can be upwards of $5,000 to $10,000. We fought, and after 8 months, I won guardianship / conservatorship in California, it's called. If I would not have won, I would have had to have sold my home and paid the $350,000 it took me to see my father again. During these 8 months, I got hundreds of letters from people all over the country going through the same thing. They didn't have a famous last name. They didn't have anybody who cared. They didn't have money for an attorney. And I thought, we have to do something. We've got to change the law. Just a common sense law that allows people who are being blocked from their loved one, from their parent, to just ask the judge if they can have visitation. It's common sense without going through an entire fight. It's so expensive, and most people will never see their parent again if the caretaker doesn't want them to. So this is now passed in 8 states, 15 other states. Well, 15 states in total have adopted it. 8 states have been our bill. But people are taking the bill and going with it, and we encourage it because it's a very common sense law. Trying to see if I left it. I want to keep it short. I know you have a lot of bills here. But It also allows if somebody's very, very ill, if that parent is ill, the caretaker has to tell the family. If the parent dies, they have to let them know and where they're buried. Right now, I have hundreds of letters from people have no idea when their parent died. They have no idea where their parent is buried. And a lot of times, if their parent has a plot that they've had, we have one person that had a plot for 30 years, wanted to be buried with his family. He was not buried. He was cremated, and the plot was sold. And this is what happens every day here in this country. So I thank you so much for listening, and it's a very common sense law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. My name's Kathleen Wright Braun. My father was Thomas C. Wright. He lived in Seattle. He was a rags to riches story started out as a book salesman and ended up owning his own publishing company and sold it for $100,000 or $100 million. And when he was age 64, all of us children, there were four of us. I have a disabled brother and then my other brother and my sister. We were very close family. My dad, we were typical 50s, 60s family. We were very close and we loved our father. I was separated. All of us were ended up separated from our father at the hands of his lawyer, his probate lawyer, and the five people around him that came in after he got his money. He suffered a stroke a year after he got his money, and all these people swooped in. 14 months, I wasn't able to see my father or talk to him or be with him. His grandchildren, his great-grandchildren, all of us were separated from him. My sister, my brother, his whole family. It was the most traumatic thing we've ever been through in our lives. The day that he died, we received a call that to come up there that he was critical and he was probably going to pass away. They wouldn't tell us why. They wouldn't tell us why he was dying. They wouldn't tell us anything. So at the hospital, we were rushed in. I asked them, they said, you can't talk to your father about health or money. And we went in there and he was in a coma. So he couldn't talk anyway. And we were told by a nurse that we had 20 minutes to say goodbye to our father because they were gonna pull the plug on him. I had to sit there for that 20 minutes knowing that I had absolutely no power over what they were gonna do. I was holding my dad's hand and I was crying and I was telling him, Daddy, we love you. Daddy, we've been fighting to see you. We've spent millions of dollars or $1 million trying to see you with lawyers and they won't let us see you. And he wiggled his finger in my palm of my hand. And I said, he moved. And the nurse says, he hears you. He hears you talking. And I had to sit there knowing he heard me and that he was going to die and I could do nothing about it. I begged them, please give him his last rites. He was Catholic. They said, oh, no, it's going to take too long for a priest to get here. I begged them, let me be with him when they pull the plug. He was there when I was born. I want to be with him when he leaves. They said, no, you cannot be there. After it all was over, my whole father's estate, none of us were mentioned in his will. They had him sign a will and a trust and everything over 3 months before he died. He married 4 months before he died. That woman took everything. The bank was involved. It was a different type of situation, but it's exactly what's been going on everywhere. As working for Kasem Cares, people right now, 1 in 3 people over 65 have dementia. It's getting worse. The wealth of America right now is held by people 55 years and older. This has turned into a business. The formula is isolate, medicate, steal the estate, cremate. I don't know where my father is. I wasn't allowed to get his ashes from the woman that married him 3 months. My dad worked his whole life for our family. We were everything to him. And he did not want all of his estate being given to lawyers and probate attorneys and other people and not his family. Yet 3 months before he died, he supposedly signed a will that left nothing to any of us children. And all of the people that were involved in this bought $1 million homes within a month of my father's passing. This bill has to be passed. It has to. There are so many people out there every day. I work with Carrie. We talk to the people everywhere, and it's the same thing. The first step is isolation. If we could stop that step, which is similar in domestic violence, first step, isolate. If we could stop that, more and more elderly will not be abused and not be allowed to be with their children when they're dying. I want to thank you. I know we have to cut this short. Thank you all.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barker and members. Thank you for having us here today and listening to us. It's a very difficult and emotional thing to go through. My name is Kelly Rooney. I am the daughter of the legendary and beloved Mickey Rooney. Mm-hmm. And there's 8 siblings. My dad was an only child and wanted a big family. So he married 8 times and had 8 kids. And he was actually the biggest kid in the house. And all of my siblings, including myself, we loved him very much, as the rest of the world did. He was part of our American film history and was beloved by a lot of people around the world. He became isolated with a secondary family towards the end of his life. Most of us would have to make surprise visits in order to see him, and he was excited to see us every time he did. We were lied to by portions of the secondary family who told us that if they could get him to safer quarters, that we could all be a family again. And we didn't know who to believe, to tell you the truth, with the secondary family. So they lied to us, and they became guardians, along with a lawyer, who in the matter of 18 months took $1 million, which that really didn't bother us kids, because what they had done was they had stolen our time from us, and us allowing us to be able to have time with our father. I urge you to, on your own time, to YouTube, Mickey Rooney Goes to Congress. And in his own words, you can hear him say how this was emotional blackmail. One of the greatest things he loved was our country. And out of 300 motion pictures, he said the very favorite thing he did was to serve our country. He was in Patton's army. He received a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, and he was very proud of that. And he received very many accolades throughout his motion picture history. And as we speak, that lawyer has those accolades in his safe. And they belong to the people. They belong in a museum, part of our history. That's where they belong. That's where he would want them to be. Anyway, if you watch that YouTube, you'll hear it all out of his own mouth and what he felt. But for his family, it was the most heartbreaking thing that we could have ever gone through, was to not be able to see our dad in his last days. We fought for 3 weeks in the court to try to get his body. My brother heard that he had passed on television. The lawyer never even called us to tell us that he had passed. We fought for 3 weeks in the court to try to get his body so that we could bury him, and we finally did. This is a common sense law bill, and there shouldn't be anybody that opposes this bill, because we're all aging, and we all want to be with our loved ones as we age. And I thank you all very much for listening to us today. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for telling the story. I know it's difficult.
Hi, State Rep Barker. Thank you, as the chairman, and also Vice Chair Williamson and Vice Chair Olson, for letting me come here and testify. I joined the Kasem Cares Foundation when I saw Carrie talking about this visitation bill. I was being blocked. My family was being blocked. And I didn't know what to do.
I'm sorry. You need to say your name for the
record. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I own Daniels. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And so I joined because I didn't know what to do. And someone brought me a newspaper article that said, if Carrie can't do anything about it, what are you going to do about it? And I started following her as she quit her normal radio show and started another radio show and started asking people, if you've been blocked, what, you know, please call in, and talked about this bill. And I knew that when I was blocked, there wasn't much time. My dad passed away. I didn't have time to get a conservatorship of him that would have been needed. And I came to you because the perpetrator lives here. And this was my second, what I call my second heart state. My first one was Louisiana. That's where I grew up. That's where my dad lived his whole life. And she lives here now. And I wanted this bill for here because I believe that there's potential for her to do this again. And it's the same story. It's the same, everything you've heard here about from the burial, you know, not being sure if you're going to be able to bury your parent, you know, the cremation, you know, she cremated my dad. We couldn't get an autopsy. It happened so quickly. It was after he was isolated. It's just traumatizing. I don't even know where to begin and end in the story because it was a gradual progression. And it got harder and harder to see my father, and it ended up that I was cut off, and it's just overwhelming. And we didn't have the money. We were one of those that didn't have the money to get an attorney. And I represent most of America, and so that's why I'm here, as a daughter. As a mother to my to my father's grandchildren, we weren't able to see him. The police said, you need to file for visitation. I'm like, what does that mean? I thought he was my father. Why do I have to file for visitation of my own father? And the police officer looked at me like, I'm really sorry. I don't know what to say. Like, he didn't know. He didn't understand it. And the more I've talked to people and the years that I've done this work with Kasem Cares, I'm now the chairman, trying to help the bill get passed in all 50 states. I have found that this is, when you talk to somebody about this, even on the plane here, I had a woman say, oh, my friend needs to talk to you. She needs to, you know, it's happening to her family. And you wouldn't believe. And a lot of times, if we don't get to visit and we have to fight for conservatorship, these people end up dying before we even have a chance because isolation is bad for them. And we were so close to my dad. He raised me single-handedly, me and my other three siblings. So it was it's traumatizing for the children, the grandchildren, the parent. And he had dementia, so he, you know, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, dementia, so it's confusing. And I never had a chance to say goodbye. And so I would really appreciate, you know, I think this bill is so important here in Oregon, and I thank you so much for giving me the chance to be here to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Representative Stark?
Thank you, Chair Barker. And thank you for your guys' stories and sharing those. And obviously this question isn't applicable in your guys' cases. Just curious about what the bill. How would this bill apply to an individual who, before they go into that, you know, late-term care stage and so forth, has intentionally tried to cut off their family? And I work with a man who has done that. He doesn't want his family to know where he is. How would that apply on this?
All it is it's not forced visitation at all. If you go and you ask a judge, you petition the judge for visitation, there's someone sent, whether it's a lawyer or somebody from the court, they go and they ask the person, do you want to see your kids? If they say no, that's it.
Great.
Done. There's no question. This is not forced visitation. And if the person is incapacitated, you look at the history of the visitation. You can look at the phone records. You can look at the history of the visitation. And you can make a call off of that. But if there are kids that definitely can be harmful, or they have criminal records, and the parents don't want to see them, and that is absolutely their right not to see them.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair Barker. And so how would that also apply to the funeral proceedings that it references?
It would be the same. If that person did not want to be with their child or did not want to have any contact with them, then that's it. That's
That's their wishes. This is what their wishes are. There's a federal bill, by the way, that most people don't know about. It was passed over 25 years ago by CANR, California Association of Nursing Home Reform. Pat McGinnis did this bill. And it allows, if someone is in a nursing home or hospital and they say, I want to see somebody, whether they're under guardianship, conservatorship, power of attorney, or just a spouse, and if they're under someone's care, and that person says, I want to see these people, they have to let them in. It's an actual law, but we don't have that for residents.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, yeah. Panel. I appreciate your testimony, and I'll
thank
call,
you.
Call Janet. O'Leara, and I'm sorry, I met you, and Julie and Rob. O'Meara. Julie Donnell. You can testify in any order, but just please remember to state your name when you start talking.
Excuse me. Good afternoon, Chair, Chairman, and committee. And my name is Janet O'Meara, and I'm from Oregon. And this is real fresh to me. And I actually reached out to Case and Cares because I was lost on what to do. I'm in a situation where my mother doesn't have money. And it would cost us a lot of money to get an attorney to fight the guardianship of my sister's in guardianship. And I didn't want to deplete my mother's funds, what she had to take care of her, to fight for guardianship. And I could have had this guardianship. My sister lives in Arizona, and my brother lives in Hillsboro. And my mom started her stages of dementia, and she had a stroke about a month after I had met with her care social worker for future plans on what to do. And she had a stroke, which it totally, she had to be retrained how to talk and everything. And so she had no voice in, you know, whether she could see me. And I had been taking care of her for 14 years. And my sister, she lived in Arizona. She'd come out every 3 years or 4 years. And they didn't have the kind of relationship my mom and I had. And my brother, he lives in Hillsboro, so he didn't have the same relationship. They just kind of didn't have that closeness. But my dad passed away 14 years ago, and I felt like I needed to be there for her because they had had a marriage for 45 years, and I didn't want her to be alone. So she was with me every weekend. So when this happened, when she had her stroke, and I was left in a situation where I thought, well, you know, let my sister take guardianship, not knowing that the guardianship had control over my visitation. And my sister and my brother had not spoke for 3 years because they had a fight going between each other. I've never been in a fight with any of my family members. So for this to happen, and it happened the day after my mom had her stroke, they locked the door. They changed the locks on my mom's house. They went in there and started doing their inventory. And I kept saying, nobody should be in there. We don't know what's going to happen here. Nobody has the right to go in mom's home. Nobody has guardianship, conservatorship, you know, power of attorney. And so anyhow, what it boiled down to is there was a period of time when I had said, you know, let my sister step up and take some of this. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and, you know, she can take on some of this responsibility. And then right afterwards is when she filed for, I got the paperwork on the guardianship. And then, you know, then once it was final, then boom, right in there. I couldn't go see my mom. She kept me from seeing her for a month and a half until I raised such a stink that I was going to have the media out there and, you know, at the rest home. And I was, you know, I was livid that I couldn't see my mom and be with her when she needed me the most in her life. And so anyhow, now I have restricted, I have supervised visits. My sister has allowed me to have supervised visits with my mother. I'm thankful that I get that. But my mom's used to me coming and taking her out to dinner or taking her out to lunch or, you know, and just, you know, I couldn't put my mother in the situation where I fight this, take money out of her mouth because of this craziness. This is just, to me, it's just crazy that a guardian can have the power, no matter what the relationship is, to that person, but have that kind of power to keep you from seeing your loved ones. And then they take all these photos off of Facebook of my grandchildren, my children, and gave it to the care home and told them that they can't visit without they had to be restricted as well and supervised. And so that's why I'm passionate about this bill. Something has got to change. This, I know the pain I went through. I went through, it felt like a death to me. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, every time I drive out to see my mother, I wonder if she's dead or alive because I won't be notified. And that's a heartbreaking feeling when you're driving and wondering, is she going to be there or is she not? So that's my story. And
awesome. Thank you for sharing that with us.
I'm Rob O'Meara, Mr. Chairman and Committee. Thanks for listening to this. I've been there with her throughout this whole situation, and we've been, so for so many years, we've been a part of her life. I mean, she'd go out and do everything with us. I mean, we've had vacations. We've went on cruises with her, and she's always been with us. I mean, breakfast and dinners and all the little stuff, and to all of a sudden have this type of thing pulled out from underneath us, you know, not being able to go see her and know where she's at or anything. You couldn't believe that this had happened to somebody, you know. I never thought that, is possible, you know, being as close as we were with her and everything, and to have people step in because they're jealous of our relationship with the person, you know, that my wife's, you know, we've been a part of her life for all this time. And I just couldn't believe that it was out there that this could be done to us. And I really think this is something that should be passed through so other people don't have to go through this, because it's, you know, it just shouldn't happen. When, as much as we love her and everything else, and I mean, we did activities and stuff with her. I mean, we do a national softball thing, and she'd always look forward to being with us out there doing things so she could watch people and stuff. So I just feel that people need to know, because we didn't know that this can happen. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you, Representative Barker and committee members. My name is Julie Donnell. Mrs. O'Meara and I have been best friends for about 45 years. I've grown up with her more like a sister. Her mother is like a second mother to me. I've never seen a mother-daughter relationship so wonderful. I've gone on trips with them. 4 years ago, I had the honor of going to Las Vegas with Mrs. O'Meara's mother. We had a blast. And I can honestly tell you, knowing her siblings for as long as I have and knowing her, this isn't money motivated. This is all about control. It's all about power. Mrs. O'Meara's older sister couldn't be bothered. She lives in Arizona. She couldn't be bothered. And as soon as Mrs. O'Meara's mother had her stroke, she was on a plane and up here just like that. So I'm passionate about this bill. This is my best friend, and seeing her go through this breaks my heart. Nobody should have to go through this. And sadly, Kelly and Ione and Catherine and Carrie, they've already lost their parent. Something needs to be done before more people lose a parent and it's too late to say goodbye. Every child should be able to go, at least go visit a gravesite, or if not a gravesite, go where their parents' ashes are spread and pay their tribute to their parents when they feel like it. This is inexcusable. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And then next I'll call Travis Rill, Wall, Travis Wall. And we won't be able to move the bill today because we don't have the paperwork ready, but so.
Good afternoon, Chairman and committee members. My name is Travis Wall, and I'm the Oregon Public Guardian. And I'd like to speak with you in opposition to the bill. And let me first say that that the concerns that have been raised by the supporters of the bill are concerns that I understand and in many circumstances would agree with. But the way the bill is constructed, I think it would have some consequences that apparently are unintended and actually could be quite problematic. But first, let me acknowledge that guardianship is a very imperfect mechanism. And unfortunately, in many states across the country, including Oregon, guardians can and do use their authority inappropriately. There aren't sufficient checks and balances on those of us who function as guardians. There isn't sufficient oversight often by the courts. There's also a fair amount of lack of understanding and ignorance by many people, both at the professional level as well as in the community at large, about how guardianships function. And as a result of all of this, oftentimes guardians are able to do things that perhaps they shouldn't. Conversely, guardianship is also something that is at time needed. Unfortunately, there are family members. There are also other people in the community that take advantage of vulnerable and dependent adults and will exploit them and bend their will to imperfect means and take advantage from the point of actually creating devastating harm for them. That's something that my program deals with every day. So we know of both these consequences. I might also share with you that although I have functioned for many years as a public guardian, both here more recently and for a number of years in Utah, I've also worked on the other side of this issue. I've led rights protection programs that have actually challenged guardianship practices, so I'm very familiar with the circumstances that the supporters are talking about. And there is actually legislation before this legislature this year that would, in a variety of ways and means, greatly enhance the protections and oversight that needs to exist around guardianship. So that's not to say that this bill is also not needed, but I think not needed in the form that it's been constructed. The area that's of great concern to me around this bill, and I've talked with a number of others in the disability and elderly community about the bill, and they share some of these concerns, is the way that, again, it's constructed. The bill, as it's as presently written, would effectively extend who guardianship applies to. Oregon law was modified back in 1995 to limit guardianship. This was one of the efforts to try to actually reform guardianship. Prior to 1995, it's my understanding that in Oregon law, it was possible to seek a guardianship of somebody pretty much because of a status or a diagnosis. This was true in many states across the country. If one had a mental illness and a diagnosis of a major mental illness, or if somebody had a neurocognitive problem like dementia or a developmental disability, that condition alone or that diagnosis alone was often seen as sufficient for imposition of a guardianship. That was a problem because many people with disabilities, many elderly people, many people with developmental disabilities and mental illnesses are not inherently incapable of making decisions. In fact, most people in those circumstances are capable of making decisions, and there's no necessity for a guardianship. So the way the law was previously constructed, it allowed guardianship to be opposed in a very broad way. And the way that the bill is presently constructed, it would reinsert disability as a status that could be used to impose guardianship. And that could substantially expand the numbers of people that are subject to guardianship very greatly. 15% of Oregonians are people with disabilities. The vast majority of those people are fully capable of living independent lives and will never need to have somebody like me or a family member making decisions for them. And nor would we want to pursue that. So this is an issue that I think needs to be addressed. I think secondly, I think some further conversation about whether the other elements of the bill will achieve the purposes may bear further examination. I don't have an optimal solution, but I can tell you that there are some mechanisms that exist in Oregon law, not always practiced, not always observed, that are intended to help facilitate things. Oregon law no longer provides for what we used to call plenary guardianship. It used to be the guardianship was considered an all or nothing proposition. And the relationship that the guardian had to the protected person, to the adult that was subject to guardianship, was seen as being analogous of a good parent to a child. Well, we've all come some distance in how we perceive adults who have limited decision-making ability. They're still adults. And oftentimes their inability to make decisions is in a certain area of their lives, but not in other areas of their lives. And so a number of states, including Oregon, have moved to implement what's called limited guardianship, where the court is only supposed to impose those restrictions on the adult in the area in which the adult cannot make decisions. In the other areas of the adult's life where the adult can make decisions, the court should acknowledge and specify in the order that those rights are retained. In fact, the way the law is constructed, there is supposed to be a presumption of that. Now, again, there is some real distance between the way the law is constructed and the way that it's practiced in the real world. And that is, it's kind of the devil in the details of guardianship. And it's something that you will again hear from people like me, just as you're hearing from the supporters today, asking you to do things to the law to try to, in fact, ensure that the law is carried out the way that it should be. So I don't want to minimize the concerns the supporters have brought to you. They are valid. They occur. They need to be addressed. We need to find the best way to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. So I would just ask, it would make sense to me from what I'm hearing the people, the proponents say, we all know how much money it costs you to go get a lawyer, and so people don't because you can't afford one. I mean, we had a young man that was here, and he left because he's making $400 an hour right on the other side of that window, which he couldn't make here.
Right.
And so it would make sense to me that I'd be able to do a quick application to a judge to have the courts take a quick look and allow a visitation rather than having to go through that.
Yeah, I'm not certain that practically speaking that might be possible. I mean, getting in front of a judge or in a guardianship matter is not like other matters. And I'm not a lawyer, so, and unfortunately, there's not somebody here today to speak to that directly. But again, I think we need to be thoughtful about that because, you know, there are some mechanisms in Oregon law that would seem to facilitate some of this, but quite frankly, some judges see it as ex parte communication that should not be taking place without everybody's counsel being communicated with and all the interested parties being communicated with. So it's a bit complicated. You know, I mean, I do think that there are mechanisms. Some states have established what they call Bill of Rights in the area for protected persons. And I would say that in general, what I'm hearing from the supporters about their concerns is that a lot of what they were experiencing were guardians that were not practicing their craft appropriately. So, I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, there are, you know, in circumstances in which my office, in which I may seek to limit somebody's ability to have contact with loved ones, that's a very drastic step. And generally speaking, that's something I'm going to go to the judge specifically and ask when I either instigate the guardianship or when the circumstances arise and when it seems to be necessary. Everybody's going to be noticed, and they're going to have a right to appear before the judge and present their side of the story. We recognize these are complicated matters. But the challenge you're talking about is a real one. I mean, you know, you will hear from us in due time about the fact that protected persons are often not represented in Oregon by counsel. Just as you heard earlier today about children, and the circumstances are no less grave. You know, there are very real issues here and people's rights that are affected. So, again, I just think we need to spend some time talking through some of these issues to make certain that we address them meaningfully.
Okay, and is one of the other things they point out, which I'm sure you're quite aware of, so in the lifetime comes, that stuff's happening pretty fast, and so we need a quick resolution, however we come out with this. Representative.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your testimony and your hard work on this important issue. I'm glad that we're going to have a chance to think through the right next steps, and I'm glad you ventilated these arguments. I want to add to this conversation the fact that the recent, during the cold snap in Oregon this winter, when several people who were living with mental illness died of exposure, I think that really showcased another real crisis that we need to deal with as we think about our guardianship and conservatorship law, and that is, you know, the hard work of balancing the kind of individual rights of people who are deeply vulnerable and the need as society to not allow someone, say, who is struggling with mental illness to end up dying of hypothermia in a parking garage. And I think it would be useful for perhaps a Judiciary Committee to consider in the context of, you know, our affordable housing crisis, but in this larger context that you highlight, the fact that we may not be at the right balance point between honoring individuals' freedom of self-determination and honoring our community's need to also safeguard people who are vulnerable. And I think that they're really valid points that you make and that you devoted your life to in this issue that shouldn't be overlooked. But I, especially as the young woman who died in a parking garage of exposures situation highlighted, there's got to be a better way than us having to say our hands are tied. You know, I don't know what the right balance is, though, but I would love a chance for us to explore further whether we can do anything to be helpful.
Thank you. Representative Boyle.
Chair Barker, is it still the case in Oregon that no one is subjected to a guardianship without the person themselves having the opportunity to appear before the court?
Chairman, Representative, actually, Oregon law does not guarantee one a hearing on guardianship. You have to be noticed of it, but ultimately it's at the discretion of the court, and that's an unfortunate limitation in Oregon law. And it's been noted because we are actually unique in that respect. We are not aware of another state in the country where that's the case. Now, the reality is in most cases a hearing does take place. But another area in which Oregon law is limited is Oregon law doesn't have a provision for providing counsel for people who don't have the resources for counsel or would otherwise go unrepresented. Whereas in most cases, the petitioner, the party that is seeking the guardianship, usually is represented by counsel. So the person that's facing the prospect of guardianship is at a very significant disadvantage.
Follow up. Well, rather than ask another question, let me just make the observation that I sense a real need here from these stories, and I'm anxious that we find a way to allow family members to be satisfied that they've had every opportunity. I'm concerned about the way we've structured it right now, and I would hope, I get the feeling that you've got some real passion about this, and I would hope that you would be willing to work with the folks that we've heard from in coming up with a solution that may actually work.
And there are two bills on the Senate side that address some of these same questions. Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really a question to you, sir, and thank you certainly for your testimony and very compelling stories. I would just ask the next time that we have a hearing on this bill that we have the drafter from LC in here, because I've got some particular questions about how the language in the bill correlates with some of the stories, some of these illustrations, very real. And if this is the mechanism to get us to where I think we can all agree is a good place to go, I don't know that the wording in the bill is quite right yet.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate the input. And since the bill is not ready to move today anyway, we will close the public hearing and the committee will adjourn. We will close the public hearing and the committee will adjourn. Ready to move today anyway.